Missourian Al Sykes served as chairman of the Federal Communications Commission as a George H.W. Bush appointee from 1989 to 1993, a time before smartphones, but digital technology was on the horizon as the new millennium approached. Sykes looks back to that time and ahead to the present in his new book, Culture Leads, Leaders Follow. I spoke with him recently and noted that his references to growing up in his native Sykeston made me think he longed for the good old days.
I make full use of technology, and if you write a book and you research, then you're familiar with Google. And so I can't imagine doing what I did as quickly as I did it without Google. On the other hand, I do yearn for the traditional ethical overlay of business, which I think has largely disappeared because, as I joke in the book, you know, my grandfather, my uncle and father, who then succeeded him, they knew their customers. They served their customers. You didn't have to dial an 800 number to get to them, for goodness sakes. And today, we're abstracted. We're not humans. We are numbers on a piece of paper. And I think as we get abstracted, the humanity of the relationship changes.
Of course, you grew up in Sykeston, Missouri, and I think that we should let the audience know that there is a connection between the name Sykes and Sykeston, Missouri.
There was. I had a great uncle who, after getting shot, having kicked a drunk out of his store, then ended up having the name of the town of Winchester named for him, or Sykes's Town.
But that's the town of the Throwed Rolls. Was that going on when you were growing up there?
It might have been, but it was not commercial then.
Not commercial, but it certainly is now. I think the whole world knows about that.
My mother was aghast at that, by the way. She was an English teacher, and the thought that Sykeston translated into Throwed Rolls was not a happy moment for her.
Throwed not being a word that she probably was real happy with. I have a couple of quotes, Al, that I'd like to bring into the conversation here and have you explain, if you would. You wrote of the disquiet that pervades society today and concern about that. Explain that, if you would.
Well, I mean, I think there's a wide spectrum. I think it's robotic politicians and the underlying concern about jobs and job stability and stagnant wages and foreign competition. I think many are concerned about the breakdown in family. We were down in Springfield for a book event yesterday, and we were in a Residence Inn, and there was a big tournament going on, and the Residence Inn was filled with families and children, boys principally, that were involved in the tournament. We learned that it was a tournament of homeschooled kids. That says something. I mean, I grew up in public schools. There were no homeschooled kids where I grew up, and so I think there is a disquiet. I think it's social. I think it's economic, and I think as people look at politicians, they don't find themselves well represented. So I think the Trump phenomenon is understandable on one level, but very unattractive on another level.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that into the conversation because this disquiet that you speak of is certainly evident in today's politics, particularly the presidential campaign.
Yeah, I think you recall that I worked with both Jack Danforth and Kit Bond, and they were relatively spontaneous. They were not scripted. In fact, I knew both quite well, and they wouldn't have, been scripted. They wouldn't have welcomed being scripted. I think so many of the politicians today are scripted, and so people see them almost as robotic, I joked at one point that people would express their concerns, and then they would get a dogma pill. So there's a chronic illness, and then there's a dogma pill that is given to people to overcome that chronic illness. And I just think that, again, is a pretty unattractive situation in a democracy that depends on an informed constituency if we're going to have a healthy democracy.
We have another quote here. As long as you say that, you quote Tip O'Neill with his famous line that all politics is local, but you say it's relational. What do you mean by that?
Well, for example, when I ended my job as chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, I had all sorts of offers to stay in Washington for a lot more money than I was making as a government employee because I had relations. I could open doors. I could use whatever remnant strength or power I had on behalf of special interests. And so I call it the informal House of Lords. And I'm concerned about that.
Well, that's certainly an active part of the Washington scene these days. Lobbyists, of course, have kind of a bad name anymore, given the influence they have on politics.
Yeah, and there's no way to. I mean, we've had goodness knows how many ethics bills we've had passed in the last several decades, and they don't really do any good because there's always an evasion, route around those ethics bills. And so, what essentially we have to do, and this is my 10th Amendment position, is we've got to give a lot more of the power back to the state and local governments, because the bigger the government gets, the more it funds that sort of what is often called crony capitalism.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the discourse, the rhetoric in today's political world?
Well, I, as you'll recall, did battle with Howard Stern, among others.
That's where I was going.
There was a coarsening of the culture, yeah. And I saw it not just with Stern's vulgar stuff, but we had all sorts of complaints. For example, Rupert Murdoch brought Married with Children to Fox TV as he was growing Fox TV. It was the first really raunchy sitcom. Marty and I, my wife, drove from Kansas City to St. Louis today, and there must have been 50 billboards on Passions, adult toys, when we would drive cross country with our kids, we would play an alphabet game. And, so you went A through Z and you got them from billboards. And so what do you say as your kid is looking up at the adult bookstore on the billboard along the road? So it's just been a coarsening of the culture. And I think that's reflected then in the Trump candidacy. I mean, can you imagine Trump being a viable candidate when we elected Eisenhower or Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan? I can't. But we've now come to a point where it is quite possible that he'll get at least the nomination of the Republican Party.
The media has changed as well.
Well, it has. I mean, Rupert Murdoch brought tabloid news to America. It wasn't that it was not to some degree available here. I don't want to, accuse that Australian of having been the only one to pollute our news, but I think he was part of it. Trump is a reality show. And, the TV fair now is filled with reality shows. And they began sort of who can find something off of an island or something, and they got worse and worse and worse. And so it's a voyeur's paradise.
What does it say about us, the consumers of all of this?
Nothing particularly good. Although, having said that, there's sort of a lowest common denominator economics. And I understand the economics. And it appeals in to our appetites. And so, I like to think that public figures, or for that matter, business figures, should be appealing to some degree to our better interests as opposed to simply our appetites. And I think to a degree we've let our appetites overcome our thinking capacity.
Part of the issue here with regard to media is the cable television and the cable shows that you're all familiar. You're almost rolling your eyes as I mention that. As the former head of the FCC, looking at what's going on in cable, over which you would have had no control anyway, what do you make of that and the fact that it's advocacy television?
Well, you're right. I mean, the FCC, to the extent that it had any potential to modulate what was said on TV or radio, it was exclusively the broadcasting. And that, I suspect, is a distinction that's lost on most people. I mean, TV is TV, radio is radio. And so, we are now at a point where it is perceived that the FCC has some power. In fact, they don't. I've got a range of thoughts about cable. I don't think cable is altogether bad. I don't mind HBO. Having movies for adults, at least they should be mature enough to weigh the costs and the benefits, nor do I mind, TV news being a bit more advocacy-oriented. But I do think it would be terrific if news more and more were pursuing truth, not simply advocacy.
Well, that doesn't seem likely to change. It's profit driven, needless to say, and apparently they're all making money.
I guess. I think MSNBC's not making much, but
not as much as the others. That's to be sure. I'm looking down here in my notes at various quotes from the book, and in the subject of politics, you talk of it as being a hybrid of chess and a Middle Eastern rug market where all rugs are not authentic.
Yeah, well, that comment was made about Al Gore. And Gore put a hold on my confirmation when I was nominated by President Bush, H.W. Bush, to chair the FCC. And Gore then went to bat for some right-wing Christian organizations that objected to my confirmation, even though he, Gore, was taking money from Hollywood. So it was just an extraordinary anomaly, I thought, and that's the point I make about his lack of authenticity to some degree.
Well, how can you be against Al Gore? He invented the internet.
I think that was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, right. I think maybe it was. Another quote here, because I want to get to the to some of the other things in the book. You write that people spend a lot of time watching TV, or if you spend a lot of time watching TV, you are toast. Binge on social media, and you will forfeit ambition. Explain that.
Yeah, well, I think, and this is probably more directed to, you know, younger people than older people. You know, when you're sort of 65 plus, you know, maybe watching a lot of TV is no big problem. But, you know, when I got out of school, the people that are now competing against us, or perhaps I should say the countries that are now competing against us, were rebuilding from World War II. And we had a lot of wind at our back. I'm speaking of the United States of America. Today we're in a global economy. Virtually everything that can be bought, certainly products and most services, can be sent from, you know, sold from elsewhere. And so this is really a global supply-demand framework. And I can tell you that in many of the emerging countries and many of those that have emerged, like South Korea, for example, those students are better prepared or working harder than generally here in the United States. And so, as I say, if you're young and you binge on TV or social media or whatever, I think you're going to have a very difficult time making it.
You know, we're 14th in the world. I've seen this figure recently in educational achievement and attainment. 14th in the world. I mean, there are some countries that people have never heard of that are ahead of us in this area.
That's right. And the unfortunate thing is we probably spend as much as any of those countries spend, but the consumption of education is done with less eagerness than it is in many other parts of the world.
Where is all of this taking us, this whole dependence on reality TV, watching too much television, listening to the kind of discourse that we're subjected to these days in the political arena? Where are we going? Are we going to have to hit a rock bottom and before we can bounce back up?
Yes. I mean, I think that cycles move and pendulums, to make, you know, use a little bit more approachable metaphor, move. You know, John Adams was one of our founders who despaired, which is to say, without an informed electorate, he believed that democracy couldn't hold. And he is, of course, not the only one that has said that. So I don't think there's any guarantee. We have been a remarkable success story. We have been an exceptional nation, but there are no guarantees that come with that.
I'm talking with Al Sykes, former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. We'll be back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to my conversation with the former chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Al Sykes, author of Culture Leads, Leaders Follow. I asked about people today being largely informed by an unfiltered social media.
I must admit to having some mixed emotions about it. When we were just three networks, as I was growing up, CBS, NBC, ABC, Everything got filtered through a handful of people. And so it really was elite TV, if you will. It was all coming out of New York and, as I say, filtered through those New York executives. And so now people, people with something to say, meaning something good to say or constructive to say or encouraging to say, are able to speak out as well. Now, you know, when you have that, you end up also on the other side with people who are raging racist or
extremes.
Bullies or yeah. extremes of one sort or another, yeah. and that's of course not good. So it's there's no filter anymore, and if we don't educate and if families don't, you know, I speak in the book about my parents were really active in my life. My mother encouraged me, and my dad told me what not to do, by which I mean she encouraged me to be a better student than mm-hmm. I was. We need active families that can somehow protect us from what is a much more wide-open society.
There seems to be a growing movement in this country today for something that I'm sure you're familiar with called media literacy. And what is being presented is to get to kids at a very early stage to teach them critical thinking skills that will enable them to, when they're watching television or listening to the radio, evaluate more intelligently what they're hearing and seeing. I'm certain that's something you would be for.
Well, I'm for that, depending on who the teachers are, to be yeah, honest right. with you. I was talking to Marty. We were going near Columbia recently, and when I was a first-year law student there, some radical came in, an anti-Vietnam radical, and they were Marxist, and they were loudmouth and boisterous, and we all went to one of the assembly halls and listened to them. I thought that was just fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was not my point of view, of course, but I thought it was just fine to listen to them. The campuses seem to be incapable, of hosting people of sharp differences. And so I find that unfortunate. And then you can get so bland, you know, that you end up with an uninterested, student contingency, whatever that student contingency mm-hmm. might be, whether it's grade school or high school or college. So I don't know. I mean, I'm all for media literacy. I'm all for economic literacy. But to some degree, who are the teachers is, I think, the most important question.
You're a Mizzou graduate, isn't that
I am. Law school. I law went to school. Westminster College undergraduate school.
Yeah, exactly. What do you make of what was going on in the Mizzou campus during this past year?
Well, you know, I'm not really enough of a student of it to yeah. have a very nuanced point of view. First of all, I'd love to be governor of Missouri for about a month because I'd try to knock some heads and say, listen, this is one of the state's most important institutions. We now need to get people together, pulling together to strengthen the university because constant attack, counterattack about the university is debilitating and hurtful to the state. Mm.
There was some discourse that focused on free speech and the ability of students and professors to say what they were thinking.
Well, and you have to have an outlet for free speech. Perhaps it's an outlet that you attempt to contain to some degree. I mean, you know, I can holler Nazi stuff at somebody, and that's free speech. But that, of course, is incendiary at the same time. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to talk about the Charleston, South Carolina, you know, the shooting that occurred at that mm-hmm. AME church and the forgiveness that followed that by the family of the victims and how that really turned the culture in South Carolina. And in a couple of days, on a bipartisan basis, political leadership got together and that Confederate flag came down from its place of importance in Columbia, South Carolina.
Shows that it can happen when all the conditions are right. It can happen.
Good leaders. Yeah. I think Governor Haley is to be admired for her leadership.
And I wonder where that's going to take her. I think a lot of people thought after she did that that she probably had a great future in national politics.
And then she took on Trump.
And then she endorsed Rubio. So
we'll see.
We'll have to see.
I think she is an interesting emerging leader. And as I say, these things tend to move cyclically. I was around when Barry Goldwater lost in 1964 all but I think three or four states. And there were a lot of commentators that said, well, the Republican Party is at an end. And, of course, it wasn't. So to some degree, it might well be necessary that the party implode before it can – be redirected.
There are just two other things I wanted to talk with you, and this is kind of bouncing back and forth, but getting back to the political situation. You spent a little time in your book talking about Citizens United and the big corporate money that is coming into the political game. What are your concerns about that?
Well, I start with too big government. You know, when I was at the FCC, we were trying to enable digital technologies. And the incumbents, by which I mean the companies that were in power, or whether it was the networks or AT&T or the Bell operating companies or Motorola, they didn't want that because that was a threat since they were analog, used analog transmission schemes. Now, I run some risk of getting off into the weeds. So my only point is that huge government attracts huge money, and then it tends to compromise, if not corrupt, politicians. And so Citizens United, which essentially freed up money in politics, even though there wasn't much restriction on it even before Citizens United, I think is maybe reason to relook at how politics are funded, but you're probably going to have to relook at that through the constitutional process, through perhaps amendments to the Constitution, which, of course, is heretical to many people. But, I use that as well in the area of free speech. I don't think that Madison necessarily anticipated that absolute free speech would result in some of what we see today.
Where are you on the originalist approach to interpreting the Constitution?
Well, I don't. Justice Scalia was a friend of mine, and I largely would support the originalist approach because, as I just noted, I think to get away from that it probably should be done through a constitutional convention or through the petition route. In other words, if you're going to change the Constitution, don't have unelected people change it, have elected people change it.
Yeah, I think Jefferson also suggested that we go through this process about every 20 years so that every generation, new generation, could be reflected in what was in that document.
Little rebellions.
Little rebellions, right.
Yep.
I have a note here that I'll get you to respond to. A paragraph from the New York Times in 1991, when you were chairman of the FCC in those days, and this is a quote, as chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, you see a world in which people could use satellites and high-speed fiber-optic communication lines to take college courses at home, have television sets double as multimedia computer workstations, use communication networks to transmit the contents of an entire library in seconds, and track down a person anywhere on the globe to deliver data. You had some crystal ball back there in 1991. What caused you to be thinking this way? What were you seeing at that time?
Well, I mean, I had the good fortune, Don, of having all sorts of really, really creative people coming in to see me and saying, we need to, get rid of this government regulation. We need to enable this new protocol, for example, going from analog to digital, or we can do this by satellite. And so, I've always had a reasonably strategic mind, and then I was getting a lot of people coming in to see me, I was synthesizing that. It turned out to be fairly prescient.
I would say so. And what was the reaction to it at the time?
Well, I think a lot of head-scratching on the part of some, but then as I say, the NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, we're both familiar with the NAB, they tried to slow it down. I mean, they didn't want satellite radio because they wanted terrestrial radio to prevail. They didn't want satellite TV because they wanted terrestrial TV to prevail. And I understand that. It struck me that I was there to represent a larger interest and not just a standstill proposition on the part of the broadcasters.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I can remember very clearly, and this would have been about the same time, I was working for a local television station, a network affiliate, and the network bosses came in to tell us, just don't worry about cable. Don't worry about cable. It'll never be more than ESPN, and that probably is not going to last very long.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You know, Ted Turner obviously, became their arch enemy as he, distributed by cable the, his first superstation in Atlanta. And then, irony of ironies, Ted Turner, who was a major stockholder of Time Warner, ended up losing a substantial amount of wealth because Time Warner, of course, merged with AOL, which was, commanded technology that was becoming obsolete. And so if Ted comes through St. Louis, you should make sure and get him in and interview him. He's a very interesting interview.
I would very much like to do that. One final thing I'd like to get your thought on, going back to the Internet and social media and all the rest of it, is it seems to me that we are going to have to be developing some new law to deal with this phenomenon, that it's still uncharted territory with regard to how to deal with it, how to control it, things like cyberbullying, for instance, and things like that, and the penalties for abuse. Have you given that any thought?
Well, I haven't particularly on cyberbullying.
No. Well, that's just one example.
But I think you raise certainly a good point. I have given a lot of thought, although not in a technical sense, to the inability to protect data. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, has come into sort of full controversy now with Apple precluding the government, from getting into the iPhone. And I thought it was really rich because the government is unable to protect its own data. I'm not precisely sure whose encryption technology is being used, but they can't even get in one single iPhone, which is, after all, a consumer device, not a big commercial data file. And so my proposition is that the government should say to Apple, we're going to let you come in without any requirement for bids, encrypt, that is to say, put a wall, an encryption wall, so that the Chinese and Russians and others can't get into our data. And in turn, perhaps you would let us in that iPhone.
That's Missourian Al Sykes, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission from 1989 to 1993. He is the author of the new book, Culture Leads, Leaders Follow. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.